Welcome to the Liver Lounge, your go-to podcast for the latest updates in hepatology, featuring discussions with the world's leading experts.
Hi everyone, thank you for listening in to this latest episode of the Liver Foundation podcast. I'm Dr. Margaret Teng from the National University Health System in Singapore, and I'm really, really honored and privileged to have today Professor Loretta Joplin. She's the medical director of the liver transplant program at Jewish Hospital, the Traeger Transplant Center in Louisville, Kentucky. She's also the assistant professor of medicine at the University of Louisville. Welcome, Dr. Joplin, and we are really pleased to that you're here to discuss the latest clinical guidelines released by the American College of Gastroenterology on alcohol-associated liver disease. So Dr. Joplin is actually the first author of these guidelines, and we are so happy that she can come and give us some insight onto the guidelines. So welcome, Dr. Joplin.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Teng. And I'd like to add that the guidelines are a committee effort. We all contributed a great deal. My co-first author, Dr. Ashwani Singhal, he was the lead author of the previous version of the guidelines. And so I had an excellent partner in leading up the effort.
Thanks, Dr. Joplin. So I think without further ado, let's just begin, and maybe we can talk first about alcohol-associated liver disease. I think this is something that has gained a lot of traction recently in the field of hepatology. Maybe you could give us a bit of insight or understanding on what's the epidemiology of ALD like globally, and also what's the burden of that in terms of causing hospitalizations or mortality.
Yeah, so alcohol-associated liver disease, the prevalence is increasing. We're seeing rising rates of hospitalizations following the COVID pandemic, escalation in individuals and populations drinking in different patterns, with rises in binge drinking, rises in daily drinking, and moderate to heavy use has increased. What was most concerning is that we've seen rises in certain demographics, particularly females presenting with more severe presentations, and we've also noticed other populations that may have some genetic underpinnings are particularly affected worse. So hospitalization rates have gone up. Medical dollar spending has gone up. Alcohol-associated liver disease has eclipsed metabolic-associated liver disease, and some recent publications that look at hospitalization burden and healthcare dollars spent. So there's a lot of papers that were published regarding increases in alcohol use during the pandemic, many of which didn't make it into the guidelines. But most concerning is that some people have allowed for their underage children to start drinking at home during the pandemic lockdowns. And so there's a new generation of people who have found alcohol to be socially acceptable, particularly because it was allowed in the home.
Oh gosh, that's really important information that I think those of us who are not really in this space are aware of, and certainly quite alarming. What do you think are some of the reasons why women and some of these ethnic minorities that you mentioned in the guidelines, why would these groups have a greater increase in prevalence of alcohol-associated liver disease, or a greater increase in alcohol use disorder?
Well, I think that for certain groups that may have a higher rates of certain genetic polymorphisms that we discussed in the guidelines, we discussed PNPLA3, and we know about the polymorphism, but it does tend to travel in certain populations at a higher frequency. There are some other emerging SNPs that may predispose people to alcohol use disorder or difficulties achieving abstinence. We know that alcohol use disorder does tend to run in families. As for females, I think some of this is cultural. And we didn't get too much into it, but the women's health study that came out of the UK really looked at women, female drinking patterns and found that women who drink daily and drink outside of meals tend to have higher incidence of advanced liver disease. Why women are doing that? You know, we conjectured about this. I think that women are, you know, globally, we're becoming more equal and we're seen as equals. And so I think coming to the table, women often want to match drink for drink and do things just as well as their male counterparts. And so there may be a cultural aspect to that. I also think that alcohol is, there's a lot of advertising aimed at women. You can't have a happy hour without a drink. You can walk through a department store and find gifts, you know, particularly for newborn moms. And, you know, there's a wine glass, it's mommy juice. And so there's kind of this flippant acceptability that, you know, alcohol makes everything better. Alcohol cures all your problems, when in reality, it causes a lot of problems.
Thanks for the answer. The other thing I think was mentioned in the guidelines is also that it's well recognized is that, you know, ALD, usually patients with ALD, they present at a more advanced stage compared to those with chronic liver disease of other etiologies. Why would this be so? And also, do you think that we can do anything to kind of, you know, move the dial backwards and pick these people up earlier?
Yeah, I believe that, you know, in our sections on alcohol use disorder and screening, we discussed some of the data that shows that when people are screened for alcohol use in the primary care setting, that problematic drinking can be caught. But screening is not universal. I don't believe that some providers feel comfortable screening or asking about alcohol use. They may not have the time. And then even if they do have the time, they may not know what to do with their patient after that. With, you know, do you refer for counseling or therapy or AA? Do you recommend a medication for alcohol use disorder? And so we really wanted the guidelines to empower providers to start to screen using the audit or audit C, to even do a one question screen for their patients if they don't have enough time to do the audit, and to feel comfortable referring for treatment and prescribing medications. So I do believe that people present at a more advanced stage because they're not being caught. For other forms of liver disease, we can, you know, we know that individuals may have obesity or have diabetes, which are risk factors for metabolic associated liver disease, but alcohol use disorder is sometimes more hidden in an individual and they may not disclose it. There's also a fair amount of, I believe individuals carry some shame about their drinking. And so you really have to have a good relationship with your patient in order to have a high degree of suspicion to detect it.
Mm, and I guess this also kind of is related to like social stigmatization that's associated with alcohol use disorder. You know, I just wanted to ask, I think you mentioned that Audit C is used as a screening tool, and I guess part of the guidelines or part of the purpose, or maybe you were mentioned that your the intent of this was to, you know, make increase awareness of Audit C as a screening tool. And I guess this is something that is very useful, I think, for hepatologists who don't really that familiar in terms of asking patients on their alcohol use. The other thing you mentioned was, you know, sometimes as providers, we kind of grapple with the issue of what do we do next if we diagnose them with alcohol use disorder. And I think that's there's a section in the guidelines that kind of talks about treatment of alcohol use disorder. You know, in your clinical practice, I mean, I know it mentions that, you know, you guys recommend an integrated multidisciplinary model of care. In your practice, is this something that is commonly done in the US, or is this mainly available in transplant centers? Do you think that hepatologists can prescribe these medications for AUD as well, or should they be given by psychiatrists?
That's an excellent question. I personally have my foot in both realms. I have a general hepatology clinic that's in a separate building than my transplant clinic. I know that in the transplant clinic, there's more resources for multidisciplinary care. We have addiction care specialists. We have licensed clinical social workers, and we have partners that that specialize in psychiatry and psychology. And so, when we have an individual who is coming to transplant who may have alcohol use disorder, we have all of those individuals involved in their care. When I'm at my hepatology practice, and I believe a lot of people have practices like this, you may not have that access to those subspecialty providers. And so sometimes it's just you. And so what I've done is I've created a packet of resources for my patients with community resources, online resources, the NIAAA Navigator. Patients can type in their zip code, the format in which they want to seek care, whether it's online or in person, and their insurance, and that can help them to make a choice if they're ready to seek out mental health resources. As for prescribing medications for alcohol use disorder, I feel that we should be empowered as providers. We have three FDA-approved medications, one of which we do not recommend in the guidelines, which is disulfiram, but other medications, naltrexone and acamprosate. These are medications that if you know the contraindications in your patient population, which ones would be best to try. Baclofen is also, it can be used off-label for alcohol use disorder, and it has a very good safety profile. And so I know that there's an increasing number of hepatologists and gastroenterologists that are starting to prescribe these medications. And I think it's really a work in progress for our field. I've been doing it now for a couple years, and I've even had more advanced training in alcohol use disorder through Project Echo. And I encourage any provider who wants to start doing this to seek out additional trainings, talk with your colleagues, get a comfort level, and start helping your patients because they may not have access to mental health resources.
That's a really good answer and very comprehensive. Just wanted to ask, for patients, the subgroup of patients with decompensated cirrhosis, I mean, apart from baclofen, it seems like the rest of the medications that are mentioned may not be very, they may be contraindicated, you know, in patients with decompensated cirrhosis. So in this group of patients, how else would you approach the management of these patients?
Yeah, it can be very challenging. In my personal practice, I've found that most individuals that start to have decompensations, they may be too sick at that point to drink, or if they do, it is sporadic. And so I just do the best that I can to support them in other ways. I focus on their nutrition. I underscore the importance of, you know, getting your calories from, not from alcohol, but from sources of protein. And I also, I will then do as much counseling as I can with the patient. I'll encourage them, if they're too sick to go to therapy, to do some self-guided learning, some readings, to try to get their families involved to help them to maintain sobriety as best they can. But yeah, the pharmacologic resources are limited in those patients.
I think this segues nicely into our next part, which is on transplant. I think in these group of patients, transplant is probably the best option if they can maintain sobriety. And I think one of the more controversial topics that have emerged in this space in recent years is transplant, early liver transplant in patients with severe alcoholic hepatitis. So what are your thoughts on this? I mean, there's always this concern, there's a risk of recidivism post-transplant. I think the literature mentions that patients with early transplant, although the risk of relapse seems to be similar to those with standard kind of duration for the transplant, pre-transplant, but it also kind of, there's one study that mentions that, you know, they have higher rates of heavy alcohol use, right? So what are your thoughts on this, and how should we, you know, assess these patients for transplant?
Yeah, that I think that is one of the biggest questions in the field right now. There are centers that are collecting data of their experience and sharing this in the literature. From the French experience and published in New England Journal of Medicine in 2011, all the way to the Accelerate trial here in the US. The Dallas consensus in 2019, I believe, was really, it empowered centers in the United States to write their own protocols and to offer this to patients that they believe would be the lowest risk for relapse. Every center right now has its own protocol and nuances. Some centers have more resources as well. I would love for the United Network for Organ Sharing to become more involved in having sort of universal guidance for transplant programs to do this, because if one program is doing it one way and another is doing it another way, ultimately you're going to create an inequity. And whenever you have an inequity in people that are this sick and in a setting where you have a limited resource, which is organ availability, I believe that we need to have a higher level of oversight so that we're all doing things in a fair and just manner.
Great, thanks a lot for this answer. I think, you know, before we reach transplant in patients with severe alcoholic hepatitis, of course, you know, there's always this option of steroids. And I think this is something that has been quite well established in the field of severe alcoholic hepatitis. Perhaps you could, you know, shed some light into how we kind of risk stratify these patients with alcoholic hepatitis, as well as how do we select those who are, you know, would benefit from steroids.
Yeah, this is from the days of Madry's discriminant function, which now has many decades of use. We're understanding that the MELD score is a powerful tool, and we're honing in on which MELD scores will most likely derive the most benefit from steroids versus MELD scores where steroids will likely not be helpful. There was this very large multi-center study led by my previous co-fellow, Dr. J.P. Arab, and I call it the Arab criteria now, which delineates the MELD range from 25 to 40, where you're going to derive the most benefit. we had thought before that maybe MILD scores that were a little bit lower, 21 and higher, you could get benefit. And we've since learned that fast fallers, people who have bilirubin that spontaneously improve on its own, may not derive much benefit from steroids. And so we're learning. Still, steroids are not that helpful. I mean, let's just be honest. The benefit that we see with them is limited to short-term survival. We need other therapeutics. There are many trials right now that are in process, particularly the DUR study. I was really glad that we integrated into the guidelines the use of IV NAC to supplement steroids. We talked in the guidelines about the use of pentoxyphylline, how it doesn't appear to improve the overall trajectory when it comes to mortality, but that it does have a signal in hepatorenal syndrome. And then some other medications, probiotics, LGG. I think that every hepatologist who treats alcohol-associated liver disease and alcohol-associated hepatitis has their own practice. And I hope the guidelines help people to feel confident in the decisions and helping these patients that are so sick.
Definitely. Yeah, I think it's really good because I think it summarized a lot of the evidence behind some of the treatments. And I would definitely give me, definitely, and other hepatologists, you know, more confidence to prescribe some of these treatments. And just as an aside, since you've mentioned Dr. Arab, I think we'll be having him as a guest on one of our future podcasts, also talking about insights into the molecular basis of alcohol abstinence and relapse in ALD. So for listeners of this podcast, please tune in for that particular episode. But for now, maybe I'll just ask, I think you mentioned that steroids are not a very good option, and the evidence about it is a bit equivocal, and you know, we don't have much therapies apart from transplant, which is also, you see, some patients may not be eligible, or it may be something very drastic that the patients may be hesitant to commit to. So you mentioned something about further research in this field. Perhaps you could shed some light into this. What are some of the emerging therapies or some thoughts that, you know, you might have on potential future therapies for alcoholic hepatitis?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I have a lot of hope for the future. The NIAAA, when they established the diagnostic criteria for acute alcohol-associated hepatitis, you know, possible, probable, indefinite, that has helped to get the field all on the same page, because I think some of the older trials, maybe patients truly didn't have alcohol-associated hepatitis, or they required a biopsy in order to be in a trial, and so that selected for a population of people that were less sick. I mean, we know the STOP-AH or STOPA trial didn't show a signal for steroids, but other trials have. And so now that we have the ability to have some confidence that the patient has the diagnosis, we don't have to get a biopsy. I think we're going to be able to include a population that truly reflects the patients that we're seeing in real life in these trials. So the DUR study, the epigenetic modulator, I'm very excited about that. I know that it's entering its next phase and will be included in ALCAPnet. And so hopefully we'll have some good data on that. Other trials, I just recently wrote a paper for clinical therapeutics with Dr. Sally Condon, looking at our clinical trials, .gov clinical trials database, to see what has been done in the past, trials that were closed out with data not reported. And I think that some of the studies that were done before we actually had more stringent clinical trial practices, we should probably revisit some of the medications that we have things in the pipeline right now. But it seems like progress is slow compared to other diseases such as cancer. We have zero approved drugs for acute alcohol-associated hepatitis. I think also that looking at microbiome modulation, fecal transplant appears to have a great deal of promise. And so I'd like to see, you know, we do a lot of off-label medications. If we can't move this along, you know, is this something that we would think about doing, or would it be cost prohibitive? I suspect it will be cost prohibitive for our patient population. But hopefully the next 5 years is going to bring great things. But beyond the therapeutics, I think prevention is also really important. And so hopefully we, as physicians, can be empowered to move the needle when it comes to the alcohol industry, the way that alcohol is marketed, particularly to youth and at-risk populations, that and we feel empowered to screen our patients so that we could have an early intervention and maybe change their trajectories.
Oh, thanks a lot. That's a really great and comprehensive answer. I think it spanned everything from your thoughts on the future of this field, as well as some of the policy changes that, you know, we all hope that we'll see in future. So thanks a lot, Dr. Joplin, for taking the time for this discussion on alcohol-associated liver disease. Before we conclude, is there anything that you would like to, you know, say to our audience on ALD?
I would like to reach out to other providers that are working on the front lines and seeing these individuals. They're so very sick, and it seems like we are right now in a crisis. I've called it a mass casualty event, because our ICUs are just full right now of people who have alcohol-associated hepatitis or ACLF with underlying alcohol liver disease. I think that if we keep working together as a field, with some people, you know, working on policy, other people working on prevention at the patient level, and others working on therapeutics, that our generation will be able to have a resolution for this problem.
Great. Thanks a lot once again, Dr. Joplin, and we really, really appreciate the time that you have spent you know, educating us on this condition. And to the rest of the listeners, to Liver Foundation Podcast, thanks for listening in, and hope you will continue to tune in for future episodes of Liver Foundation Podcast. Thank you.
We have come to the end of the episode. Thank you for joining us, and stay tuned for more captivating discussions.